Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Good morning. Hello. Hello. Let's see if I can get the volume just right. Okay, I did that just so that everybody that's on their cell phone will turn their cell phones off. No, just kidding. But you should turn your cell phones off anyway. Say my three favorite words. I gotta go. Okay? All right, so I'm recording right now. This is Bible 241, and it is September 1st. We're in the chemistry chapter still. I see the schedule on the left-hand side. Looks a little blurry to you. It doesn't look blurry to me. So today is September 1st. We're going to talk about chemistry all week this week, but it probably won't take all week to get through it. All right? Maybe even I'll get through it today. I'm not sure. But if that's the case, then I'll move up these other discussions so that we have plenty of time before that first exam. When is your first exam? First exam is the 22nd of September, and that's on a Tuesday, right? And how many Tuesdays away is that? One, two, three. Is that right? One, two, 3 weeks away. All right, so you got to be studying even though that exam is 3 weeks away still, and the chapters on that are going to be 1, 2, 3, and 6. Right, what I wanted to say, you have to be studying for that exam, because if you don't understand what I talked about last time in lecture, then this time in lecture won't make any sense. Right, and that's just how it's going to be. If you didn't study about what we talked about, then you're like behind already, right? And you're going to have a really bad feeling, be anxious about it. So don't go down that road. Learn everything as we talk about it in lecture. That's the best thing to do. Okay, so anybody have a question on the schedule? No? Okay, let's see what I can do with that schedule to get it out of the way. Nice. Like so. Last time I had mentioned the periodic table, and here is the periodic table, although it is mislabeled here. It says atomic masses, and I got this from the chemistry department. I don't know if they've modified this particular figure yet. There, I like that. Okay, it should say what? Periodic table, and you probably have a book on this. Last time I said you have to understand or know what these chemical symbols stand for. Like H stands for hydrogen, right? And what was another one? C, where is C? Okay, C stands for carbon, O for oxygen. And what about Na? That's a curveball. That's sodium, right? And K stands for potassium. So you know that list that was in your PowerPoints. You have to know that. So I'm going to give you a periodic table for the exam that looks just like this. And I might ask you, what does Na stand for? And so you have to tell me what it is. But I could also ask you, what is the atomic number for sodium? I'll spell sodium out. So then you'll have to know that Na stands for sodium and be able to read the periodic table to know where the atomic number is and know something about that. Who can tell me a little bit about atomic number? What does it mean? The number of protons that are inside the nucleus. And it is the top number that I see. It's right above the chemical symbol for that chemical. So how many protons are in the hydrogen atom? There's one, right? And I think maybe you could remember that. And if you know that, then you can find the atomic number. All right, what atom has two protons in the nucleus? All right, and this is not part of the class. I didn't ask you to memorize what He is, but that's helium. That's got two. Let's see. I might ask you, how many protons are in a carbon atom? So you're going to have to look over the periodic table, find C, look at the atomic number, and indeed it is 6, right? 6. So you should be able to do that. Periodic table looks pretty complicated, but it's actually really nice and simple once you can visualize it. Let's look at the first couple rows. Last time we talked about orbitals, right? And what kind of particle can be found in an orbital? Is it a neutron, a proton, or an electron? An electron, yeah, what charge does the electron have?
Negative.
Negative, which exactly neutralizes a positive charge in the nucleus, that's a proton. And the shells are arranged in different levels. So the first shell can accept some electrons, and how many electrons can the first shell accept?
Two.
And when you look at the periodic table, that is your answer key. Look at the first row. How many elements are in the first row? There are two. All right, so that means that in that first shell, you can put two electrons. What about the second shell? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Right, so again, here is the answer key as to how you fill up electrons in shells. And the third shell is exactly the same. Then it gets maybe a little bit more complicated, but we don't get into that in this class. All right, so the periodic table is going to be your answer key for a lot of questions on the exam coming up. So become a little familiar with it. If you're not familiar with it, you could probably ask your lab instructor or see me during office hours, and we can go over it a little bit. Okay? All right, so that is periodic table. That is, I just downloaded this from Blackboard, so it is in Blackboard. And it was what? Study guides? Exam study guides button? No? Lecture slides. Lecture slides button. Okay, and just scroll down to the bottom of that page. All right, does anybody have a question regarding that periodic table? Everybody's pretty good with that? Okay, all right, that's nice. All right, so we looked at the schedule, looked at periodic table, and I think we're about ready to look at some slides. And let's see if I can get this projecting really nice for everybody. All right, so I see it here. And let's try this. What's happening? Okay, I see two slides. Both are in focus. And what about for you guys? It doesn't look too bad. Yeah, for some reason it looks better. All right, so I'm happy about that. So we're going to continue on with chemistry. So I do want my pointer back. All right, I want it here all the time. All right, so we talked about organic compounds. What the heck is an organic compound? And a compound means it has more than one atom. So it's a molecule that has a carbon covalently bound to a hydrogen atom. At least that, right? At least that. That's what makes it an organic compound. And way back in this chapter, I showed you an organic compound, hexane, cyclohexane, benzene. These are all organic compounds because I see that carbon atom and I see a nice covalent bond to a hydrogen right here, right? So that's the definition of an organic compound. But hexane is not naturally occurring in us, right? So it's an important organic compound, but it's not important biologically to us. Right. There are some compounds that are very important because of our biology, but they are not organic. And one is carbon dioxide. Why is carbon dioxide not an organic compound, even though it has carbon and oxygen? It is not bonded to a hydrogen atom. Somebody said that. That is exactly right. Okay, so we just started looking at the structure to know how there can be different substitutions for these H's that will produce different kinds of compounds. And remember, we said there are four important classes of biological compounds. The first one, which we just got into, is sugars. The second one is lipids. The third one is going to be proteins. And then the fourth one is going to be nucleic acids. All right, so let's continue on with knowing something about sugars. And remember, sugars or carbohydrates, or the name carbohydrate, right, is a contraction of carbon hydrate, because somebody realized for every carbon in a sugar there is a water molecule or two hydrogens and an oxygen. Right? Not really a water molecule, but two hydrogens and an oxygen. And you all know that if you have two hydrogens and an oxygen as a molecule, that is the water molecule. Okay, I want you to be able to recognize these hydrocarbon chains with all these hydroxyl groups on it to be sugars or monosaccharides. You don't have to tell me which one is glucose or galactose or fructose, but be able to identify them. We'll do some exercises to see them pretty soon. These all have six carbons. There can be sugar molecules that have five carbons, but all of these right here have six. And what does this OH group, this substitution, instead of a hydrogen right here, I see a hydroxyl group. What does that allow, or what property does it give this particular molecule? Kind of a high-level question, but I want to go over this answer. It's pretty important. All right. Notice that there is a nice covalent bond. That's what this little line stands for. Sharing of electrons. You should remember covalent bond is sharing of electrons. So here's a carbon, and it's sharing a pair of electrons with oxygen. And then that oxygen is also undergoing another covalent bond with this hydrogen. And when hydrogen is bound to nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus, it produces a polar covalent bond. So this part of the molecule becomes a little bit negative, and this part becomes a little bit positive, which means that this molecule has polarity just like water. And if it has the same properties of water, they will dissolve in each other. So sugar molecules dissolve in water very easily because of all of these polar covalent bonds, because of that oxygen. If there was a sulfur here, sulfur here, sulfur here, same thing would happen, right? And instead of oxygen, if you put another atom right here, the same thing would happen. What other atom could you put here to make this very soluble in water?
Phosphorus.
Yeah, phosphorus. Nitrogen, for instance. Yeah, and we got oxygen. The configuration would be a little bit different, but then it would be a polar compound or hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Hydrophilic, loving water, right. All right, so we can make something a little bit more complex like a starch or glycogen if we put a couple of those monosaccharides together. If we put two together, we get a disaccharide. If we put hundreds together, we get a polysaccharide. If we put thousands together, that's a polysaccharide. If we put millions of glucoses together, that is still a polysaccharide. Okay. Starch is a polysaccharide that is made just from glucose, and that's what we find in plants. Animals produce a chemical that's very similar. It's called glycogen, but the branching pattern is a little bit different. Right? But the building block for glycogen is, tell me what the building block of glycogen. It's going to be a monosaccharide, that's a hint, and in particular the name is glucose, right here, glucose. Right? That's a nice 6-carbon sugar. So how would your body make something like glycogen? Well, let's start with 2 glucose molecules, and I see them here. All right, so here is a glucose molecule. This part in the ring stands for a carbon atom. So I got a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and there's another one, 6, right? So that should remind you of a nice, simple monosaccharide. This is glucose. And this bond over here is to an oxygen, right? So that's not a carbon. And so if you take a glucose and a glucose, and if they're put together just in the right way, look at what atoms are next to each other. In one glucose, there is a hydrogen atom. And on the other glucose molecule, there is a hydroxide. And so that's H2O. You know what that stands for. So that H from one and the OH from the other can be removed from the glucoses, and when that happens, that forms a nice chemical bond between the glucose molecules, and now this disaccharide is called maltose. And there's another product in this reaction, which you all can see. It is water, right? So when we take water out of a couple substrates for a chemical reaction, and we call that a dehydration synthesis reaction because we're synthesizing maltose by removing water, a water molecule, from those 2 monosaccharides. A dehydration synthesis, I don't see synthesis on this slide, but that's probably a good thing to know a little bit because you're synthesizing maltose. Another way we talk about that is condensation. That's a condensation reaction because we're removing water. All right, let's look at the bottom row. We have a glucose and a fructose, and glucose can donate an OH, and the fructose can donate a proton and form a nice covalent bond. So this is another example of a disaccharide. And what's another product that's being formed in this reaction?
Water,
right? So this is, what kind of reaction would this be? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, so that's a common theme in your body when you want to make a more complicated molecule from building blocks. A dehydration synthesis reaction is one that is readily available and very useful to put various compounds together. All right. Well, I see a one-way arrow right here, and that doesn't necessarily have to be the case in every time. The reverse reaction can take place, that this disaccharide maltose can be broken down into its building blocks, which are 2 glucose molecules. So on this slide, put a big arrow over here, right? So we're going to take a maltose and break it down. But if we're going to break down maltose, we need another molecule. What else do we need? We need a water molecule. So here is maltose with water, and with the proper enzyme, that water can be broken apart and put on the maltose molecule so that you end up with two glucoses. We call that hydrolysis reaction. Hydrolysis because it involves water breaking apart that disaccharide. Okay, so if water is ever necessary to break apart a more complicated molecule, we call that a hydrolysis reaction. All right, so here we have something that's very similar. We've got sucrose, which is a disaccharide, right? And with an enzyme and water, we can break sucrose down into its building blocks, and that is glucose and fructose. And what kind of reaction would that be? Okay, just like the row above it, that's a hydrolysis reaction as well. Okay, so this reaction can go forwards and backwards depending on your metabolism and what's necessary in your body. All right, so remember, starch or glycogen is like many of these maltoses put together by, how would you make a glycogen from maltose molecules? What kind of reaction would be used in your body? Not shown on this slide. But it would be dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, and how would your body degrade starch or break starch down into glucose? What kind of reaction would be used to break starch or glycogen down into glucose? A hydrolysis reaction. Yeah. All right. So that reaction is like a building block of metabolism for you. Dehydration synthesis or hydrolysis reactions. Okay. So I think we're ready to move on to lipids. Right, that's another class, the second class. Lipids are insoluble in water because water is a polar solvent. It's a polar compound, and lipids are hydrophobic. All right, so what kinds of atoms are missing from lipids, or most lipids, that don't allow them to dissolve in water? There's something missing from a lipid that prevents them from dissolving in water. Oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen, sulfur, right? So that's what we mean by hydrocarbon chains. When we look at a lipid, we see carbon and hydrogen, but none of those other four atoms. So there are no polar covalent bonds, and therefore it won't form hydration spheres, and it won't dissolve in water as a result of that. All right, so here is another nice exam figure. Let's look at the center. I see three molecules in the center. And can you see a carbon with two hydrogens on them? Followed by carbon with two hydrogens, and again, and again, and again, and again. This is a long hydrocarbon chain. I don't see oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen, or sulfur, so all of these bonds are nonpolar. So this part of the molecule will not dissolve in water whatsoever. This is a fatty acid, because if we look at the terminal carbon, I see a carboxyl group. Right, carboxyl group. And that's one of the functional groups that we looked at last time. So this carboxyl group is the acidic group. And this right here is the fatty part of the molecule. So this is a fatty acid. And I see three of them. If we take another molecule, this is kind of similar to a sugar structure. It's called glycerol. Glycerol has three carbons. So how many carbons does glycerol have compared to a glucose? It's a difference with just a nice simple integer number. How many carbons are in sugar? Six. Glycerol has three. So in a sense, maybe you could chop a glucose molecule into two, and you can end up with two glycerol molecules under the right kinds of conditions. All right, so here are the OH groups in glycerol, and with the right enzyme, a fatty acid can move into this location and donate this proton right here. So we got H2O. And then this fatty acid is going to be bound to a glycerol. And if that happens three times with three different fatty acids, then this thing right here is what we call a triglyceride. And maybe you've seen that on if you've ever had a blood test, right? That's one thing that is commonly measured in people. Are there triglycerides or fats in their blood? All right, so what kind of reaction would be used to make a triglyceride? Or saying, what reaction would be used to take a glycerol and three fatty acids to make a triglyceride? So here is that triglyceride, one big complicated molecule. Dehydration synthesis reaction. So, we got to find something else. So we should see water being produced by this reaction. Is there water? Oh, look right here. Here it is. Three waters corresponding to these three bonds to make that triglyceride. So, you should know what the building blocks of a triglyceride are. What are the building blocks? One glycerol, three fatty acids. Precisely it. Okay, and these fatty acids can be different. They don't all have to be the same, but they should be a fatty acid. Okay, well, you have triglycerides in your body, and maybe sometimes your body wants to break them down into those building blocks, glycerol and three fatty acids. What kind of reaction would be used to break a triglyceride down? Hydrolysis reaction, just like when your body breaks down glycogen. It would be a hydrolysis reaction, and okay, you'd have to just turn this arrow around. You, of course, would need three water molecules to end up with a glycerol and three fatty acids. All right, so are you beginning to see that nice common motif that's used in your body to build big molecules, then to break them down? Okay, so here are some examples of fatty acids. A long hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl or acidic group on the end. And here is palmitic acid. We call this a saturated fatty acid because at every carbon, you have two hydrogen molecules. Right. There are other kinds of amino acids that we call unsaturated fatty acids because if we look at this carbon here and this carbon here, we see that these two carbons are sharing two pairs of electrons. And that means that this carbon can only form a covalent bond with one hydrogen. And the same for this carbon here, only one hydrogen. So all of these carbons are not completely saturated with two hydrogen atoms. And that's where that term unsaturated fatty acid come from. All right, so in some locations in a unsaturated fatty acid, there are double bonds between the carbons. And you know what? That changes the shape of that molecule. And so that can also be used to change the function of what's happening inside of a cell. All right, so these are fatty acids. Be able to recognize them. You don't have to name that the top one is palmitic acid and the other one is linolenic, but be able to recognize these two things as fatty acids. And one is saturated and the other is unsaturated. All right, here's going to be one of your favorite molecules in this class, because it's an important learning step. It's a phospholipid. So it's a lipid. It's like a triglyceride. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride once again? Glycerol and three fatty acids. In a phospholipid, one of the fatty acids has been substituted with something special. You don't have to know the name of it, but it's a phosphatidyl group. And I see it right here. But when you look at this illustration, can you see a glycerol molecule incorporated into this illustration anywhere? Where's that glycerol? Is it a horizontal or vertical arrangement that we see right here? Vertical. I see one carbon, two carbons, three carbons. Here is the glycerol backbone for this phospholipid. In the first two positions we have just the usual old fatty acid, so this thing is well on its way to becoming a triglyceride, but it's not really, because look at this third carbon. There is an inorganic phosphate group bound to it, and that inorganic phosphate group is bound to another group that has a nitrogen in it, all right? And that this phosphorus right here means that these bonds become polar. This is the polar end of the molecule. Here is the nonpolar end. A better way of saying that for our discussion is that this is the hydrophilic end of the molecule. Here is the hydrophobic end. All right, so the question could be asked, is this molecule going to dissolve in water or not? Well, part of it will, right? The polar end will. So one way we can illustrate this molecule is that this phosphate group over here, right, we're just going to draw it as a large group, and these long hydrocarbon chains from the fatty acids are what we call tails, right? So the hydrophobic tails and the hydrophilic head group on a phospholipid. So what is so magical about this thing? So I'm going to turn on the light, and like so, do a little bit of drawing.
on the board.
Here is something that you have in your refrigerator at home. Oh, nice dark marker. I like that. All right. So here is a bottle, right? And it's filled with a fluid up to that level. But if you're careful and you look at it, you notice that there is something that's separating here fluid number one and fluid number two. They're separated from each other. Does anybody have a bottle like that in your refrigerator? And what the heck am I talking about? Okay. Yeah, this is a salad dressing bottle. Right, and in salad dressing, you have two components. You have oil and you have water. And the top fluid over here is going to be oil. And if you put that on your salad without shaking it up, what you're pouring on your salad is just oil and not very tasty because all of those nice tastant molecules are down here in the water part. So what do you do before you pour the salad dressing on your salad? You shake it up and you mix these two compartments together, so when you pour it out, you get some of the tasty stuff and some of the oil at the same time. Now take that salad dressing bottle and put it back into the refrigerator, right? And what's going to happen to those two different compartments of fluid? They're going to separate once again, right? There's going to have to be a special machine in there that makes that happen. Okay? It just happens automatically. And the big reason why it happens is because these molecules here are hydrophobic, or nonpolar. They don't want to associate with water down in this region, right? And they're on top because they're not as heavy. So they float on top of the water, right? So the density of the oil is different. So everything that likes to dissolve in water, including water, is on the bottom, and oil is on the top. And these molecules just magically separate themselves from each other just by the physical chemistry of those molecules. All right, well, what molecule are we talking about? We're talking about a phospholipid. All right, so this is a modified triglyceride. On the first two carbons, you have these long hydrocarbon tails. All right, so here is the hydro what? Hydrophobic part. And then up over here, you have the head group. And this is hydro, go ahead and tell me, because I can't talk and think at the same time, philic, that's right, the hydrophilic region. So here's a special molecule. It has two of those properties put together. So let's take this molecule and drop it in the salad dressing bottle. Where is it going to end up? Is it going to end up over here on the top, or is it going to end up over here on the bottom? And do you have to place it there? I just want you to like hold it above the bottle and drop it, let it go. Where is it going to go once it gets into the bottle? On the top? You don't like the top. Well, okay, what about the bottom? You don't like the bottom either. Okay, but you put it in there. Where is it going to go? It's going to go to a special location, right? So remember, here is water. I'll put H2O. So the phosphate group is going to end up in the water, and where the hydrophobic tail is going to end up? Right, up in the oil. And will that happen automatically all by itself? Absolutely. Yeah, you don't need a machine to go in there, tweezers or anything to put it right there. It will automatically do that because here is the hydrophilic part, here's the hydrophobic part. Now things are in a nice equilibrium. Anybody got a question about that? That's a pretty important concept to see. All right, so instead of just dropping one of these molecules, let's put 1,000 of these molecules into the salad dressing bottle. And what is that going to look like? It's going to look like this, but what, 1,000 times over. And so all of the head groups are going to be in the water, like so. All of the hydrophobic tails are going to be poking up into the oil mixture, like this, and like that, and like that. And nothing special has had to happen. When you look at this structure right here, right, with the head group into the water and the tails up into the oil, I see something that looks exactly like a membrane, like a cell membrane or an organelle membrane. So what's interesting about this, then, you can see that one of the basic structures of life likes to assemble itself all by itself, which is pretty fascinating, I think. Okay. So that's one way to think about a phospholipid. It is the building block of all membranes that are inside your body. And we're going to see how it's just a little bit complicated in just a little bit in the next chapter. Okay, if you just have water, if you just had water in a bottle, so you don't have oil, so here is another kind of bottle, and it's all water. And we drop a bunch of those phospholipids into this water. There is a very special structure that's going to form, right? What part of that phospholipid is going to want to be around water? Yeah, the phosphate head group, right? So we got a head group over here. Right, and the head groups kind of like to associate themselves with each other because they're polar. Now, where are all the hydrophobic tails going to be? Random arrangement or in one particular direction? They're all going to face each other on the inside, right, excluding water from the center of this structure. And not just a ring, but it's a sphere. All right, so now you have this thing. This is what we call a micelle. The hydrophilic groups are pointing out into the water. The hydrophobic parts are sticking to the inside. And now if you look at that thing, that should remind you of a cell, right? With a membrane that surrounds the cell. And that has built itself all by itself, nothing special other than the physical chemistry properties of that molecule. All right, so that's a phospholipid. You have to be able to recognize. This is an exam figure. You have to be able to recognize this molecule as I'm circling it right here as a phospholipid and then know some special things about that particular molecule. Right, there's a hydrophilic and a hydrophobic part to it. Yes?
So in here, when you talk about
okay, so ask me that again. I couldn't quite hear part of it.
When you're talking about the building block,
oh, building block of phospholipid. Great.
Is it going to be just phosphate?
Okay. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? One glycerol, three fatty acids, right? And a phospholipid is a modified triglyceride. So a good question would be, what are the building blocks of a phospholipid? It would be glycerol, two fatty acids, and a special phosphate group. Okay, so that's how I like to think about it. Okay, so here is that micelle, and you can see that the phosphorus head group is associated with water because this head group is polar and water is a polar molecule, and it forms this nifty hydration sphere around it. So this micelle doesn't just float up to the surface like oil because it can form this micelle. Okay, here is another kind of lipid, and it is mostly made up of hydrocarbons, which is a carbon, which I represent that by the intersection of these two lines right here. There's a carbon atom right there, and there are hydrogen atoms in various locations, and we don't always draw them out because it gets too complicated. Whenever you see something that looks like this, I want you to know it's a lipid, but a special kind of lipid. Right, when you look at this molecule, does that remind you of anything? What does it remind you? If you just look at the structure of this molecule, anybody have, a beehive. Ah, because of all of these little cells right here, beehive. Yeah, that's probably a pretty good way of thinking about it if you see that. All right. When I see it, I see a step, and another step, and another step. So it kind of reminds me of a staircase. I don't know. Do you see a staircase? Can anybody imagine a staircase right there? Maybe, I hope. Okay. When you see something that has that molecule that has a staircase kind of look to it, that is what we call a steroid. And this steroid right here, that's on the very top, that is cholesterol. And that is a lipid. Cholesterol does not like to dissolve in water because I don't see oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen, or sulfur anywhere on the molecule. It is hydrophobic. Cholesterol is a building block of other kinds of steroids in your body, sex steroids and other steroids that regulate glucose and sodium metabolism. All right, so cholesterol is an important building block. If you have too much of it, it produces disease, but you have to have the right amount in order for your body to produce testosterone and estrogen and other kinds of important hormones. So here's an example of cortisol. Maybe some of you have heard of cortisone. That's a steroid. It's going to have this look to it. So it's a cholesterol with some modifications. Right? And you can see then for testosterone, it's a cholesterol with, again, some modifications. And when you look at the difference between testosterone and estradiol, which is an estrogen, does it look like these two compounds are similar or really radically different? What's different between testosterone and estradiol? Only this methyl group is missing an estradiol, and instead of a carbonyl group, you have a hydroxyl group. So there is a small change in this molecule. I think that's really a small change compared to the overall structure of the molecule. So what you will recognize here is that small changes in structure can produce large changes in function. Right? When you change the structure, you change the function. So even small changes in structure can make the whole difference between testosterone and estrogen, which is going to be a huge difference inside your body. All right, another kind of lipid. Here we have a long hydrocarbon chain, and it continues over here. It's been folded in half. Here is the carboxyl group on the end of that fatty acid, and a covalent bond over here, which stabilizes that particular bend. This thing is a prostaglandin. That's an important signaling compound. And the building block for prostaglandins are fatty acids. Fatty acids are the building block for prostaglandins. These are important hormones in your body, and there's all kinds. I see E1, F1, E2, F2. These all have different functions because they have a little bit different shape, but these are all prostaglandins because what is the building block of a prostaglandin? Fatty acid. All right, so here is the acid part, here is the fatty part of that molecule. In this particular case, it's been modified with some hydroxyl groups. All right, so it changes the structure, changes the function of that particular fatty acid. So if you see something like this, you're going to say prostaglandin, and we're going to look at prostaglandins in this class and see what function they have. All right, so that's lipids. So what do I want you to know about lipids? Triglyceride building blocks. Right, and here's that long hydrocarbon tail or chain, so that is hydrophobic. Triglycerides, here is a look of what a fatty acid looks like. The fatty part is a hydrocarbon chain, the acid part is this carboxyl group, unsaturated on the bottom, saturated on the top. Here is a triglyceride that's modified with a phosphorus and this nitrogen right here, so this is a phospholipid, and a phospholipid is a building block of what kind of structure in your body?
A membrane,
yeah, as a matter of fact, all membranes. You could say all membranes. All right, and here we have a steroid, right? I see a staircase kind of arrangement of this molecule, and then a prostaglandin, which is just a fatty acid that has been bent in half, and then some substitutions have been placed on the hydrocarbon chain. All right, so those are all lipids. So those lipids all have something in common, and that is they are hydrophobic. They don't like to dissolve in water, except for that phospholipid, a kind of a strange, interesting exception to that rule, because part of that molecule does like to dissolve in water. Okay, proteins. What's the building block on protein? Everybody knows amino acid. Here are some amino acids. This, the one on the top, is just a very general form of an amino acid. All right, so what kind of group are we familiar with that is acidic? Our carboxyl group, right? A COOH. So this is the acidic end of a amino acid. And then you should know what a NH2 is. NH2 is an amino group. So if we put an amino group and a carboxyl group, add them to a carbon, okay, we have what? An amino acid. As a result of that. This central carbon, and I guess sometimes we call this an alpha carbon, it's always got to have an amino group and a carboxyl group and a hydrogen, but this group coming off the top of this central carbon can be various kinds of molecules. They can be hydrophobic, they can be hydrophilic, they could be acidic groups, there could be basic groups. So this R stands for variability. So various things can be substituted in for this R. There is no atom or molecule with an R, right? It's just there to mean that it can have different substitutions. Here are some examples of some amino acids, valine and tyrosine. These are nonpolar because when I look at that substituted group right here, I only see hydrocarbons, I don't see nitrogen, phosphorus, oxygen, sulfur in this part of the amino acid. All right, so this is a nonpolar. Here's another nonpolar, because when I look at this group up over here, I mostly see what? Just hydrocarbons. Right, I do see this hydroxyl group up on the top, but that's not enough to compensate for all of this nonpolar, all these nonpolar bonds in this area. So tyrosine is another example of a nonpolar amino acid. Okay, some polar amino acids. Here is one with a couple other amino groups and a nitrogen. This is a basic because it can accept protons from solution. And here is one that has a the SH, what did we call this SH group? That's a sulfhydryl group, right? And it's cysteine, and if two cysteines bump into each other, right, then this hydrogen can come off of this amino acid and the hydrogen from the other, and a nice covalent bond can form between two sulfur atoms and two different cysteine molecules, right? And that's a covalent bond. What's the strength of a covalent bond? It's a strong. We call that a disulfide bond when you have two sulfurs bonded together like that. And cysteine, aspartic acid, again, has this carboxyl group, so that means that it is acidic. This is the acidic group. And when this hydrogen comes off, what is left on this oxygen if this proton comes off? It's not a hydrogen atom, but if a hydrogen nucleus comes off, what's left on this oxygen? Okay, if a proton comes off of this carboxyl group, this oxygen then has an additional electron, so you would have to draw a little minus sign right here. And can you see that that little minus sign right here would then help allow this aspartic acid to dissolve in water, number one. And number two, if this is a negative charge, what other charge would like to associate with this one? A positive, right? So if there is a molecule like arginine that has a positive charge because it has accepted an acid or a proton from solution, then this arginine would like to bond to this aspartic acid over here for those charges to neutralize each other. All right, so these different groups can be substituted at this location, right? Labeled by an R on this illustration. All right, so y'all said that amino acids are the building block for proteins, so let's build a protein. Here is amino acid, let's start here. Here's amino acid number one. Does this remind you of an amino acid? Carboxyl group, amino group, right? So amino acid, and we haven't defined what's in this R position, but it could be a number of different things. Here's amino acid one, here's amino acid number two. Can you recognize that as an amino acid? Not too difficult, right? Here's the amino group, here's carboxyl. Amino acid 3 and 4, these things can form a long chain, right, building a protein or a peptide. And what kind of reaction do you think your body uses to put amino acids together? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? So one of these will have to get rid of an OH and the other an H. Okay, and that's going to form a water. Same thing on the other end, an OH and an H. And then in between these two, an OH and an H. So now we have a nice covalent bond between the carbon in the carboxyl group and the nitrogen in that amino group. And this covalent bond is very strong. It's a stronger kind of covalent bond than usual. Right? And so when you take four amino acids, join them together with dehydration synthesis reaction, you form three of these bonds that we call peptide bonds. And in the process, what else is made? Water, three water. That's the condensation part. The synthesis part is now you have one long molecule from these four separate amino acids. That is a nice peptide bond. I think maybe I'll have you draw this next week in lab on a blank piece of paper, okay, just like this, for an extra credit point if you can do that. But you should label it what kind of reaction if the arrow is going down. Dehydration synthesis. If the arrow is going up, it would be a hydrolysis reaction because water would be used up and it would break that bond. And that happens with really strange radical kinds of pH conditions. All right, so proteins can be broken apart in your stomach because your stomach is very acidic. Others can be broken apart in your small intestine because your small intestine is very basic and those conditions are necessary to break this really strong peptide bond between amino acids. All right, so if you have a bunch of amino acids put together and the chain is less than 100 amino acids, sometimes we call that a polypeptide. What do we call it when we put hundreds of glucose molecules together? That is a polysaccharide, right? So poly just means many, many, many. These are polymers. That's where the word polymer comes from, poly, right? So a polypeptide is a polymer. Glucose and, not glucose, but glycogen and starch, right, are polymers of glucose. In terms of a protein, if you have more than 100 amino acids put together, we call that a protein. Okay. And of course, that is a polymer as well. So when we put amino acids together, it can form different kinds of structures. And we want to understand, analyze the structures that can be produced when amino acids are put together. The first kind of structure that we're going to realize is what we call the primary structure. Primary structure is just writing down, okay, what the particular sequence of amino acids is when it makes a chain. There are 20 different kinds of amino acids. You looked at a couple already. Here are five that you looked at. So if you put these five amino acids together in a particular way, right, that will tell us what the primary structure of that polypeptide is. Right, so this amino acid will be different than this one and different from that one, or maybe they could be all the same, but in any case, right, the primary structure will be the same if there are the same amino acids in those three locations. And a protein or a polypeptide, when it is being built, is just a nice linear sequence of amino acids. Think of it as maybe like a chain or something, and every link in the chain is an amino acid. And in order to make a protein that has the right structure, it has to know how to spell out that protein in terms of the amino acid, right? So if you switch out, you change this R group, you change what amino acid is, that would be like changing the letter in a word. And when you change the letter in the word, what do you do to that word? You change its meaning, and it might be nonsense, right? If you change the amino acid in this polypeptide, then you change the sense of that particular polypeptide or the function of that particular polypeptide. So primary structure is just how we start to spell a polypeptide out by the sequence of amino acids. Okay, that's primary structure. If particular amino acids are put together in just the right sequence, right, then it's going to bend and fold in a particular pattern. If the amino acids are such in the right order, then there can be hydrogen bonds between various amino acids at distant locations from each other, and it might form this thing that looks like a coil. We call this an alpha helix. So we call this secondary structure. Alpha helix is secondary structure. Another kind of structure is what we call a beta pleated sheet. It's not on this illustration, but a beta pleated sheet is just going to be some zigzag lines, kind of like an accordion bellows, right? Zigzag sharp corners instead of nice rounded corners. And what stabilizes those sharp corners will be the same thing as what we see in the alpha helix, and that is hydrogen bonds between different kinds of amino acids. All right, so tell me, what is the strength of this hydrogen bond? It is weak, right? It is a weak kind of bond. So this kind of structure can be disturbed pretty easily because these are all weak bonds. Nonetheless, right, this is secondary structure. What is the building block of secondary structure of a protein? It's got to be the primary structure. It has to have the right sequence of amino acids before this alpha helix or its cousin kind of form, the beta pleated sheet, will ever develop. All right. Well, doesn't make up the whole protein. There are amino acids on either end of this alpha helix, and there can be hundreds or thousands more amino acids joined to either end, right? And that's going to make the whole protein. So here we have a complete protein. Here's that alpha helix, and here are some other segments within that protein, and they can bend upon each other. Right, and so this is what we call the tertiary structure. This is really the three-dimensional form that whole molecule is going to take when it is built. All right, and it's got to have this shape for the protein to have that particular function. We call this the native conformation or configuration of the molecule. And it's stabilized most of the time by hydrogen bonds, which you told me are weak bonds. Right? If those hydrogen bonds are broken, then we can change the shape of this particular protein. Change the shape, we're going to change the function. We call that denaturation. So this protein or the tertiary structure can be changed by heat or by pH, and maybe in your notes you could put down even salt. High salt concentrations can change the configuration of this protein, and the function is going to change. So if it's an enzyme, then the enzymatic activity is going to stop. The other thing is that denaturation is an irreversible process. Irreversible. If you heat a protein up, you're going to denature it, and then if you cool that denatured protein back down to where it was, it won't go back to the original shape. Right? And so that's what we call a catastrophic, irreversible change in that protein. So egg has the yolk, which is mostly lipid, and then it has the egg white, which is proteins. And in an uncooked egg, it looks nice and clear, and it's kind of runny. And we can denature all of those proteins by heating it, right? And what happens to the look of those of that all those albumin proteins? Yeah, they turn white and kind of solid, right? And so that is denaturation. You could do that with pH. You could do that with high salt concentrations or by heat, mostly done with heat. And then if you take that fried egg and put it in the refrigerator, does it go back to looking like a runny egg? It does not, because denaturation is an irreversible process. There's only one example that I can think of which is an exception to that rule. Right, when a protein is denatured, that it can be renatured in a certain way, and that is when somebody gets a permanent in their hair. Right, somebody can go to a beautician and they can put your hairs in curlers a certain way you would want the hair to bend, and do kind of a radical chemistry, perform radical chemistry on that hair. And so a bunch of disulfide bonds are broken and then reassembled. That changes the shape of all of those proteins, and the curlers are taken out, and then you have curly hair. That's what we call a permanent, right? That is denaturation. And beauticians can reverse that process, right? And I don't know what they call it, but that would be renaturation. So those hair proteins can go back to their original shape, and somebody could have whatever shape proteins your hair would be. It could be curly, it could be straight, or whatever. Okay. All right, so if anybody can think of a process where a protein is denatured and then you can get it back to what it looked like before, I would like to know, because I can only think of that one example, right? And that's, what, less than 1% of all the times that a protein can be denatured. So tertiary structure is the overall three-dimensional shape, not of just one segment of a protein, but of the complete protein. And it's not a very stable configuration because it's mostly hydrogen bonds that are holding the protein together. We call that the tertiary structure. So what's the building block of tertiary structure? Secondary structure, or this alpha helix. And what's the building block of alpha helix? Primary structure, that's right. Okay, so remember, good place to make sure you understand is what primary structure means. It just means a particular sequence of amino acids, and think of how would you spell a word correctly in order for it to make sense. Those amino acids have to be in the right location, right? Maybe one specifically has to be in the second location, right? Just like in some words, a particular letter has to be the second letter in that word for it to make sense. Some proteins, because there might be a certain location, could be deep inside the protein or on the outside. There can be other kinds of organic compounds that like to associate with this area. And in this particular case, I see a heme group. A heme group is a very large organic molecule, and in the very center of it has an iron ion. It has an iron atom. And that changes the whole structure of that protein, and it can become what we call a heme. And a heme, if we put four hemes together, we get hemoglobin. And that iron atom right here has the ability to bind oxygen, Right, so hemoglobin is a molecule that can associate with oxygen and deliver it in all the different places in your body. So red blood cells are responsible for delivering oxygen, right, from your lungs to your tissues, and red blood cells are loaded with hemoglobin molecules. It's four of these heme groups that are put together. We call that the quaternary structure of a protein. So here is a heme, or a hemoglobin, and I can see four different heme subunits coming together, and they all have that pigment on the inside, that really large organic compound that has an iron atom in it. Okay, so a quaternary structure. What's the building block of quaternary structure? Tertiary structure, which is what? The right shape. So in order for these four molecules to come together, they have to have the right shape, which is the tertiary structure. And the tertiary structure becomes evident because the secondary structure is correct, and that means also then that the primary structure is correct. Let's go back to the previous slide. Here I see a long polypeptide chain, and remember, it's made out of amino acids, and in that R location, there can be different substitutions. There could be a carboxyl group or an amino group. So here we have an amino acid with a carboxyl group. Over here we have, and it's a distant location, here we have an amino acid with an amino group, right? And the carboxyl group forms this negative charge. The amino group, when it accepts a proton, has a positive charge, right? These two amino acids like to associate with each other and form an ionic bond, right, which stabilizes this little bend in the protein at this particular location. Notice there are many amino acids in between these two. So it can be a long loop or a short loop. And this ionic bond is also kind of a weak bond, right? So it's kind of a weak bond, but it's stronger than a hydrogen bond, right? And it's also going to be very susceptible to changes in pH and sodium and chloride concentrations, or salt concentration will affect this ionic bond. Right, what is the strong kind of bond that you're aware of? Covalent bonds. And if we look at this protein and we go all the way down over to here, here I can see a cysteine amino acid, and then I can see another one over here. Remember, the cysteine has a sulfhydryl group on it, and so if you have these two sulfhydryl groups, and if they come close to each other, they can form this disulfide bond. The two hydrogens can be removed, and then you're left with a sulfur and another sulfur covalent, just sharing two electrons, and this is a strong bond. It strongly holds this protein into a particular configuration. Right, so we have ionic bonds, covalent bonds. You can have groups in different amino acids that form a hydrogen bond, which is pretty weak. And then here is the fourth one that I mentioned to you long ago, and I don't want you to forget about it. Here we have just hydrocarbons, right? I don't see oxygen, phosphorus, nitrogen, sulfur here. And here are hydrocarbons as well. What can you tell me about these hydrocarbon substitutions on an amino acid? Are they hydrophilic or hydrophobic? They're hydrophobic. That's right. They're oily, right? They don't want to be associated with water. And since these two groups don't want to associate with water, they will associate with each other. And they do so with something we call a van der Waals force. This is the weakest kind of force, right? And for this class, we can consider that a bond, but a very, very weak bond. So van der Waals bond is between two groups that are hydrophobic, right? And so they will want to associate with each other. Just like the tails in that phospholipid like to stick up into the oil, right, in that salad dressing bottle. So that will help stabilize the tertiary structure of this protein, but extremely weak, right? So heat and other things will break that bond very, very easily. All right, so what are the four kinds of bonds that can stabilize the tertiary structure of a protein from order of strength? What's the strongest? Covalent, disulfide bond. What's another one? Ionic bond, right over here. Hydrogen bond, and then the weakest is the van der Waals force, right? There's a question or two, I think, someplace in your study, either online or at the end of the chapter. I forget where it is. So don't forget about that van der Waals force. Proteins. Their structure can be changed by adding other kinds of molecules to them, and we looked at sugar molecules and lipid molecules. Indeed, proteins can be modified further by adding a sugar molecule to it. That's what we would call a glycoprotein. So So it's a protein that contains a carbohydrate. And mucus is a really good example of a glycoprotein. Sometimes we call it a mucopolysaccharide. It's a protein that has a lot of sugar groups attached to it. And you know about mucus. It's both sticky and slippery and all kinds of stuff all at the same time. A lipoprotein is a protein modified with a lipid someplace, right? And then others, like we've seen, can contain a pigment like hemoglobin. And if it's hemoglobin, that pigment can bind oxygen. So hemoglobin is a molecule that can carry oxygen throughout your body. Hemoglobin is one. Myoglobin is very similar to hemoglobin. And I'm not going to ask you to really memorize anything in Table 2.4, but it's interesting to look at. Okay, nucleic acids. This is the fourth kind of important biological compound that we're going to be looking at. And the basic building block of a nucleic acid. I don't know if anybody knows that, but you have to know that now. Okay, so, let me see. Building block of a polysaccharide is a monosaccharide. Building block of a triglyceride is glycerol, three fatty acids. Building block of protein is amino acid. Okay, and the building block of a nucleic acid is a nucleotide, which we have right here, a nucleotide. Sort of like the amino acid in a protein. And nucleic acids are long. It's a long chain of nucleotides, just like a protein is a long chain of amino acids. So what are the things that make up a nucleotide? Well, there's a phosphate group, inorganic phosphate, which is a PO4 group. And then here is a carbon atom. But if we count the carbons, we see that it only has 5, not 6 like glucose and fructose or galactose. This particular sugar molecule is going to be a ribose. Anytime you hear a word with an OSE on the end of it, you should kind of know that it's a sugar molecule of some kind. Ribose is a 5-carbon sugar, and it can be modified a little bit to form a 5-carbon sugar, but with different properties. And then on this 5-carbon sugar, this ribose is an organic base. It's just an organic compound, which you know how to analyze, right? Just carbon with hydrogen on it. And it also has probably an amino group, which can donate, which can accept a proton, right, from solution, so that makes it a base. So these are the three things that make up a nucleotide: a 5-carbon sugar, a phosphate group, and a basic kind of molecule, all put together just in this arrangement. All right, so here is a nucleic acid. And I see that it's a long chain. And so if we look at the chain, I see a ribose and a phosphate, and a ribose and a phosphate, a ribose and a phosphate, ribose and a phosphate. And then on the other end, we have the bases sticking out. And in DNA, the bases are going to be guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. Just those four. No other bases will be incorporated into the molecule. Let's look at the next slide. All right, this is just what I told you. All right, so here is a nucleic acid. And this this ribose right here is missing an oxygen in one of these locations, and so this is not the usual kind of ribose. We call this a deoxyribose because it's missing that oxygen atom. Deoxyribose nucleotide makes DNA because that stands for deoxyribonucleic acid because oxygen is missing from one of these locations. There is another kind of nucleic acid, which maybe you're familiar with. It's called RNA. RNA has a ribose sugar, but it's not the deoxy form. It has the oxygen in the proper location, so we call that ribonucleic acid as opposed to deoxyribonucleic acid. And just that little oxygen in one location makes the whole difference between DNA and RNA. Again, a very small change in the structure of a molecule radically changes what its function is. Right, so nucleic acids can be long chains of nucleotides, and different chains can associate with each other because guanine is a relatively large organic base. Cytosine is relatively small, so both of these can pair up very nicely because one is big and one is small. They'll fit perfectly in a particular space, but they also have a special arrangement that each can form three hydrogen bonds. Right, so these three hydrogen bonds help stabilize the association between guanine and cytosine, not just their shape. Right, this other association down here in the bottom, thymine is small, adenine is a large molecule, but these don't like to form three hydrogen bonds. They just like to have, or only two are allowed. And so these two fit together very nicely in adjacent chains. And so we call this the base pair rule for DNA. Guanine is always going to base pair with cytosine, and adenine is always going to base pair with thymine. So typically we say GC and AT. That's the base pairing rules. And we call that the law of complementary base pairing. So DNA is two chains of nucleic acids that join together. And here is a nice way to look at it in a linear sequence, right? So here is the first chain. Here's the backbone, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar. And then here is the organic base. This would be the nucleotide. When they're all added together, right, this forms a chain. How would your body add different nucleotides together to make a chain? You could take a guess. We talked about it already. Okay, what's the building block of a polysaccharide? Monosaccharide. Let's take two monosaccharides, put them together to make one molecule. What kind of reaction was used? Dehydration synthesis. Let's take a fatty acid and glycerol, put them together. What kind of reaction would be used? Okay, what did I ask for? So it was a triglyceride, right? Okay, fatty acid and a glycerol, put them together. What kind of reaction would be used? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Put two amino acids together. What would your body use? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Your body puts two nucleic acids together. What kind of reaction would your body use? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Maybe I have a slide of that, maybe not, but it is. All right, so that's what forms this long chain. And here is another long chain of nucleic acids. They can join together to form something which to me kind of looks like a ladder. The handrails on either side is what the phosphate sugar backbone, and the rungs that you would step on are the bases, and they follow the proper base pairing rules, which is GCAT at this location. And what's holding these two chains of nucleic acids together to form this one larger molecule? Hydrogen bonds. And is that a strong or weak association? That's a weak association. And in this case, it's really good, because sometimes we would like to have this molecule zipped up to where you can't see what the base pairing, what the nucleotides are. At other times, we would like to unzip the molecule and have two separate chains, because the order of bases in DNA and RNA is information. So to get at the information, it has to unzip. And to unzip a DNA molecule, does it take a lot of energy to do that? No, it's easy because of those hydrogen bonds. And when you're done, it's easy to put it back together again because they're just simple hydrogen bonds. Okay, so if the primary sequence is, well, the primary sequence is always correct, and it forms this structure over here. This is what we call, right, a helix. This is a double helix in this particular case. So this is the form that DNA exists in. So how many chains of nucleotides do you see in DNA? I see one on the left, one on the right. It is always a double helix. There are two chains of nucleotides that make DNA. That is a rule. DNA makes a double helix. Okay, here is that ribose sugar, right? I see five carbons, you can count them out. And the hydroxyls and hydrogens are all on the same side of the molecule. So these are both ribose sugars. And here is ribose that has a OH group. If it's a deoxyribose, then guess what's missing from it? This oxygen. And is it missing an oxygen here? Indeed it is. So this is the deoxyribose. Here is the ribose. And it makes a huge difference because ribose is not used to make DNA. Deoxyriboses. Ribose is used to make RNA nucleic acids. Right? Just that little substitution right there makes a huge difference. There is one other difference between RNA and DNA. And what are the base pairing rules in DNA once again? GC, AT, that's how it kind of runs around in my mind. It might for you too. You could say it the other way, doesn't really matter. But GC, AT, all right, the important thing there is T. We see thymine in DNA. We never see thymine to make RNA. It's never in an RNA molecule. So instead of thymine in RNA, you have a different kind of base, which is uracil. All right, so what makes RNA different from DNA is that you have one oxygen here, and in one of those bases, you have uracil instead of thymine. And what is uracil going to base pair with? Adenine. It's going to base pair with an adenine. Okay? All right. So the base pair rules for RNA would be GC, okay, AU instead. Okay? Oh, the other thing about RNA, it's never double-stranded. It's single-stranded. It doesn't form that alpha helix. It will always just be one long strand of nucleotides to make that nucleic acid. So that's another big difference. RNA has an oxygen, has uracil instead of thymine, and is always in a single-stranded configuration, not double-stranded. What molecule is double-stranded? DNA is double-stranded, right? Okay. So that information, or the sequence of bases in RNA, is always available. Nothing has to unzip. Right? Okay, the kinds of RNA that are produced, we're going to start with these three first. Okay, so RNA is used to make a protein. And protein is made on a workbench, and that workbench is RNA, ribosomal RNA. So the workbench is a ribosome, and ribosomal RNA and a couple proteins and a couple different kinds of RNA come together to make a ribosome. So rRNA is ribosomal RNA, and what does it make? I was kind of talked about it in a roundabout fashion. It makes the workbench for protein synthesis, right? rRNA makes the workbench for protein synthesis. And how do you make a protein once again? What's the building block? It's the building block for protein. Amino acid, yeah, so in order for this ribosome to make a protein, it needs amino acids. And it gets amino acids from all over the cell. There's another kind of RNA that's wandering around the cell all the time looking for a particular amino acid, and then it delivers it to a ribosome so that it can be incorporated into a protein. That RNA that brings amino acids to the ribosome is called a transfer RNA, or tRNA. Another way to think of tRNA is taxi RNA. What is it taxiing around? The building blocks of the protein, which is amino acid, right? That's a tRNA. Well, remember, what is the first kind of structure that determines the overall function of a protein? Remember, you saw primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, okay? The primary structure, right, is the basis of all kinds of shapes that a protein can take. And so what is the primary structure? It is just the sequence of amino acids that will make up a particular protein. It could be cysteine, 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 cysteine all the way through, or it could be cysteine, arginine, then cysteine, cysteine, cysteine all the way through, or some specific combination of those 20 different amino acids. So if a cell wants to make a particular protein, it's got to know what that exact sequence is. Right? There has to be a dictionary that says, how do you spell out this particular protein in that amino acid language? And that sequence is contained in messenger RNA. Sometimes we just call that the messenger. Some people don't even say messenger RNA. But the messenger RNA determines what the primary sequence or the primary structure of a protein is going to be. Right? And there's got to be a specific sequence of adenine, right? And cytosine, guanine, and uracil in order to make a particular protein. That's the message or messenger RNA. All right, and this RNA is made from DNA. DNA is going to be a template. All right, and you know what? That's the last slide for this particular chapter. Wow, I actually allocated three lectures right here. Okay, well, we're done. When is lecture over? 12, okay, so we get about 10 minutes left. So let's ask some questions, and maybe I can come up with some answers that are useful for you. Do you have any questions about chemistry? So far, so good. Okay, I'm going to end this particular slideshow, and I'm going to go back to, all right, this folder right here, and I'm going to look for something that says flash quiz. Okay, this will be fun for you. This will help you a lot. All right, here is the video of it. Ah, it's in a folder. Let's see. Oh, I got to get this in the right order. So open with picture viewer, photo viewer. Let's try that. Where did it go? Oh, I know where it went. It went to the other side. It is, right there. Okay, and so what I want to do is do this. All right, what are you looking at? Nothing, not much, right? Just a blank page, right? So when you see a blank page, you can just take a deep breath and relax, and we're going to go to the next page. All right, so what kind of molecule are you looking at here? I see a phosphate group, I see a ribose, and I see a base, an organic base. What kind of molecule has phosphate, ribose, right, and a base? It's a nucleotide, right, nucleotide, that's what we talked about today. Now, what kind of nucleotide? Is it a deoxyribonucleotide or just the usual ribonucleotide? This is a ribonucleotide because here is the oxygen, right, can't be deoxy. So here is a ribonucleotide. This is a building block of RNA, okay? All right, so that was a lot of work with that one. It will get simpler. And what do we do here? Take a deep breath, and then we go to this. I see a substitution group. What is that? That's a functional group, but remember there are different kinds of functional groups, and which one is this? Sulfhydryl group. This can make disulfide bridges between different amino acids in a protein, right? Sulfhydryl groups, and that would be what? A strong kind of bond. Rest, what is this? NH2 is amino. What molecule are you really familiar with that has an amino group on it? And amino acid, right? Amino acid. Here is, what we find on the other end of an amino acid, a carboxyl group, right? That's the acidic group. And here we have phosphate. Okay, when we say phosphate in biology, we usually mean this whole monstrous thing right here, not just the phosphorus atom, but PO4, phosphorus with four oxygen atoms in this arrangement, phosphorus with one double bonded oxygen and the other two to these hydroxyl groups. We call that inorganic phosphate. So when I say phosphate, usually I mean inorganic phosphate. It's this thing right here, which is a little bit more complicated than just a phosphate atom. All right, so phosphate group. And then what do we have here? Sugar. What kind of sugar? Monosaccharide. How many carbons are in this monosaccharide? I see six. Yeah, that's going to be important later on. All right, so this could be a glucose, could be galactose, for instance, but it is a monosaccharide. If we put two of these together, what kind of chemical reaction would be used? Dehydration synthesis reaction, and you would end up so here's a monosaccharide, you would end up with a disaccharide. Yeah, disaccharide, and that is a carbohydrate. All right, and then here, what is that? Here is the fatty part of this molecule. Here is the carboxyl group, which is acidic, so this is a fatty acid, but a particular kind of fatty acid. It's a saturated fatty acid because at every carbon you have a hydrogen. That's a saturated fatty acid. How's that going so far? I hope you're not freaking out completely. All right, but you can look at this at home. You have this in Blackboard. Oh, wow. What's going on here? Do you see what's going on here? I hope so. I see some building blocks. What is this molecule? Glycerol. Glycerol has how many carbons?
Three.
How many oxygens? How many oxygens? One, two, three. I see three oxygens. How many hydrogens? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, right? Eight hydrogens, all right? That's going to be important for you in a little bit, all right? But these three carbons. And then what are these things here? Is this one molecule? It is not. It's three different ones. It is three what? Fatty acids. Here's that carboxyl group. Here's that long hydrocarbon chain. It's not even drawn out all the way. It's kind of abbreviated, but that's what this dotted line means. So one glycerol and three fatty acids can be used to make a triglyceride with what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis. So when a triglyceride is formed, what else is formed? Water. Can a triglyceride be broken down? Yes. What kind of reaction would be used? A hydrolysis reaction. So what else would be necessary to break a triglyceride down? Yeah, almost. What else? Okay. Somebody said water. Okay. And another water. And another water. Three waters is what I was getting at. So I kind of tricked you with that, right? But that would be a hydrolysis reaction. Okay. What is right here? Sugar. What kind of sugar? Monosaccharide. How many carbons? Six carbon monosaccharide, right? And it forms this ring structure. So that would be a monosaccharide. That would be a monosaccharide. You don't have to tell me which one. But it looks like fructose to me. Okay. What is this thing? This is a micelle. And what's the building block of a micelle? Phospholipid, right? So the head group is the phosphate part. This is the hydrophilic part. And the tails right here pointing to the center of the micelle. This is the hydrophobic part, right? Because these are just the long tails from a fatty acid sticking out in this direction. All right, so what kind of bonds are stabilizing this structure on the inside? There are going to be bonds between these nonpolar groups. It's a very, very weak kind of bond. It's the weakest kind of bond. Van der Waals force, that's right, Van der Waals forces, okay? On the inside, hydrogen bonds on the outside. Okay, what about next? Oh, what is this? Is this a sugar protein? Lipid, and in particular, steroid is what I want you to say, right? You don't have to identify which steroid it is. The one on the top is probably always going to be cholesterol. That's the building block for these other steroids. And steroids are hormones in your body. What do we got here? Fatty acid, and it is unsaturated, right? Because you don't see hydrogen. What's this? Amino acid. Amino acid. And what is here? A phospholipid, right? So here is the phosphate group. Here are the two fatty acids joined to this glycerol. And so this is a phospholipid. What is a phospholipid a building block of?
Membranes.
Right. What are these? Prostaglandins, right? It's a fatty acid that's been folded and modified. That's a prostaglandin. Okay, what do we got here? It's a structure of a protein. What kind of structure? Secondary structure. What's the building block of this structure right here? Primary structure. And this is a building block of something. Okay. What is this helix? What is this alpha helix a building block for? It's a building block for the tertiary structure of a protein. Okay. So the building block, tertiary structure of a protein is? Alpha helix, or the building block of alpha helix is primary structure. The sequence of amino acids have to be perfect in order to form this structure. I don't have beta pleated sheet. Do a Google on that or Wikipedia. Oh, what do we got here? Phosphate, ribose sugar, and organic base. It is a nucleotide. Now, what kind of nucleotide? You got two choices, ribose or deoxyribo. Deoxyribonucleotide, and this is used to make RNA or DNA? That's a question. Okay. DNA. That's what DNA stands for. Deoxyribonucleic acid, right? It's made out of these things with different substitutions up here for that base. All right. Where are we? What's that group? Hydroxyl group. Here we have glycerol. Here we have a carbonyl group. And what is that? It's a nucleotide. What kind of nucleotide? Ribonucleotide, used to make RNA. Right. All right. So we've looked at all of them. We're going to look at all of them again real soon. Sign-in sheet is going around. Maybe I'll start out next time doing a flash quiz, which is going to go something like this. All right. You don't see anything here? What's that? And then what's that? And what's that? And what's that? Okay, so you'll be able to go through all of those things in less than a minute. So we're going to go through that in like 30 seconds, which means you're going to be really bored on the test coming up, right? Okay. Yes, or a link to it. I have it in a video form. Okay. Yeah, so next week we're going to move on to the next chapter after we review just a little bit. Okay, and that's going to get us in really good shape. Thank you for the exam coming up.